This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is sponsored by the Good Book Company, inviting you to check out Luke for You, Volumes 1 and 2 by Mike McKinley, for reading, feeding, and leading. Visit www.thegoodbook.com for more. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen.
If you were neighbors outside Atlanta with Ernie Johnson Jr. and his wife, Cheryl, you'd soon learn they are the parents of six children. They've adopted four of them. Three of them have special needs, and one of them suffers from a fatal disease, muscular dystrophy. But the rest of us know Ernie mostly as the Emmy-winning studio host of Inside the NBA on TNT, where he works alongside Charles Barkley, Kenny Smith, and Shaquille O'Neal. You'll also see him working for Turner and CBS on the NCAA Division I Men's Basketball Tournament, Major League Baseball, and the PGA Championship. Most recently, he's the author of Unscripted, The Unpredictable Moments That Make Life Extraordinary, published by Baker. In this book, he takes us behind the scenes of his family and studio show, and also his outspoken Christian faith, including his struggles as a father and husband and survivor of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. He joins me on the Gospel Coalition podcast to discuss the ups and downs of family and career, including his much-shared commentary following the 2016 presidential election. Thank you for taking the time, Ernie.
Colin, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Ernie, watching how much and how hard you work and considering the needs in your family, how do you do it all? I mean, how do you leave room for those unscripted moments where you can listen to God and serve others?
I think that's probably something that every listener can relate to. I mean, I think we're all in a situation where the demands of work, and the demands of family, that intersection gets pretty crowded sometimes. But I think it's a lot of that is simply perspective, and it's living your life with your priorities in line. To be totally honest, I always didn't get that, Colin. It was, there were times in my career when I wanted people to think that I was, that I was defined by being a husband and a father, and but my life was reflecting the fact that I was really tied into my job, and that was driving me, and it was really what was kind of foremost in my mind, and I needed to change that, quite honestly. And really it was late in life for me. It was when I was 41 years old. It was 1997. And I kind of was just looking at my life and saying, is it only what I'm making it out to be? And really wasn't until, I returned to faith and placed my faith in Jesus Christ that my life took on a whole new meaning and a whole new purpose. And then it, somehow, remarkably, the demands of work took their rightful place. And those were behind the demands of being the husband and father I should be.
Well, I had to laugh about this line in your book from your mom, but it must have hurt for you growing up when she said, "Dad's not here tonight. He's out speaking to a group of dads about spending time with their kids." what did you learn from having a famous father that has helped you as a parent?
Well, he taught me everything, Colin. It was one of these things where he was a baseball player back in the 50s for the Milwaukee Braves, and then became a longtime announcer for the Atlanta Braves after the move south. And so when your life is baseball, in a 162 game season, a lot of that is going to be on the road. And so, there were a lot of things that he missed that he wanted to be at that, either me or my sisters were involved in. And my mom was the one who was kind of holding down the fort, in Atlanta. But what was great about that upbringing, is that while I wasn't old enough to really appreciate his career as a player, because I was 3 years old when he retired, but I tagged along at the ballpark with him as he announced games a lot growing up. And I think the message I have for parents out there is that you always have to be cognizant of the fact that your kids have superpowers. They see and hear everything. And I know that because that's the way I was. I was a sponge around my dad. He didn't have to sit me down and lecture me about here are the keys to life or here are the ways you should live your life. He just modeled them. And I was taking mental notes all that time as I was growing up about how to treat everyone with respect, how to work hard, how to not consider yourself special because of the job you have, how to always take the high road. And those are things that I just, I learned from him, and I've tried to pass down to my kids through the years. And my dad was just a humble, talented man who appreciated what he got to do for a living. And that was the special part for him, that he could stay around baseball all his life. Not the fact that he had this high-profile job and, hey, what are you going to do for me now? Because look at me, aren't I important? He never had that. And so those are the things that I learned from him and have tried to hold on to and have tried to pass down. I'm on a daily basis, I'm just trying to be the best version of Ernie Johnson Sr. that I can be.
Well, tell us a little bit about adopting your son, Michael. Some people commiserated after you had adopted him and after you learned of his special needs that you would not have adopted him if you'd known he had muscular dystrophy. But you say that that could not be further from the truth. Why?
Yeah, because when we decided to do this, Cheryl, my wife Cheryl and I will be married 35 years in August. Back in 1991, we were living the script. I had this great wife, I had a boy and a girl, had a great job, and kind of the feeling was, why deviate from the script? This is going great. And I came home from work one day, and Cheryl said, you know what we need to do? And I said, I don't know, chicken or fish, whatever you feel like. She said, no, this has nothing to do with dinner. I think we need to go to Romania and adopt a child. And she had seen ABC News, their show 2020, had done this huge expose on what was going on in the orphanages in Romania. And a lot of the disabled kids were just being warehoused over there and forgotten. And so we decided, yeah, if we can help one of these kids, let's do it. Let's adopt one. And so here began this unscripted phase of our lives. And as Cheryl went there, we did not know who she was going to, what kind of child she was going to meet, or if she was going to be successful in adopting a child and bringing him home, him or her. And the first child that they brought out to her was a little boy who was almost 3 years old, and he couldn't walk and couldn't talk. He just made noises. He had a lot of developmental delays and had, there were some serious issues he was going through. And my wife from Bucharest called me and said, when this nurse handed me this boy, she said, don't take him. He's no good. And then she said, but I don't know if I can go the rest of my life wondering whatever happened to this blonde-haired boy in this orphanage. I said, well, bring him home. And it was about a year after we had him home, and, he was at the doctor's a lot, and they were trying to figure out, neurologically what was going on. We even had doctors tell us, Colin, well, look, he's never going to bond with anybody. He's probably not going to talk. We can fix his leg and we can, help him walk. But their ideas weren't very promising. And then he was diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, and there's no cure for that. Your muscles don't grow. They just weaken and deteriorate. And a lot of kids don't get out of their teens with that. But here's the deal. And for the people who did say, well, I guess if you knew that, you wouldn't have done this. I was like, look, we have no guarantees with the children we have right now, the biological children we have. We have no guarantee that in 5 minutes something catastrophic might not happen that's going to change our lives forever. And what would we do then? Say, oh, I knew we shouldn't have had that kid. No, you deal with what happens in your life with those unscripted moments. Are you going to embrace the unscripted or are you going to run from it? We choose to embrace it. And so we said, no, this is he's part of our family. And now we've got word that he's got this, and we're going to do whatever we can to make life as good for him as we possibly can. And Colin, every day now I wake up and I see a miracle. Kid's 28 years old. I call him a kid. He's a man. He's 28 years old now. He's defied the odds already. And his spirit has been such a blessing to so many people. And you know, we ventured into this adoption saying, well, maybe we can, you know, we can help somebody and make his life better. He's done so much more for us than we've done for him. I can't even explain it. And so, you know, we adopted him. We adopted a little girl from Paraguay 2 years after that. And then about 6 years ago, we adopted two more girls who were in foster care in Cleveland. And they're now 15 and 17. So, look, it's a circus at our place, but at least we get in. At least we get in free.
Well, let me ask about those two daughters, Allison and Ashley. Your adoption with them does seem to be somewhat different. You write in the book that Cheryl and I wondered if we had done the right thing, if we had overestimated our ability to parent a couple girls who had endured their life experience. And you go on to say that the difficulty of parenting them has led to some even division between you and your wife. What's the best counsel you've received on how to serve them and to trust God in the process?
Well, I think that, you know, when I'm writing that, I'm just trying to be brutally honest with folks. I'm not going to try to sugarcoat anything and say, yes, we've adopted four kids, and as soon as you do it, magically everything is great. You know, that's not been the way it is. Obviously, when you adopt a couple of girls who at the time were 9 and 10 years old and had been through a lot, they'd had a half dozen of homes, and they had learned to not trust anybody. They had, you know, their history was that, you know, somebody might say that we're home, but who knows how long that's going to be. At one point, our daughter Allison had asked my wife, Cheryl, she said, how long is forever this time? Which gave you an idea that, you know, they'd been told, yeah, this will be your forever place before, so why should they believe it? And so, look, we came into this knowing that there was a lot of baggage. As I told people, I said, look, they didn't have many possessions when we adopted them, but they had a lot of baggage. And we're still unpacking that. And sure, it has led to really deep conversations between Cheryl and myself about how we best parent, you know, and we've had various ideas and sometimes opposing ideas on what the best way to do it is, but we work through that. I mean, and that's just part of it. And if anything, it's made our bond even stronger, even though there are times where it was like, Cheryl, you don't get it. This is the way we should do this. No, Ernie, you don't get it. This is the way we should do it. But it's made us stronger and brought us together even closer. And so, you know, our whole mantra in our house is trust God, period, which really was birthed out of my episode with cancer in 2003 to 2006, in which my pastor, Kevin Myers, and I had sat down when I was diagnosed. And I was like, you know, Kevin, I feel like punching God in the nose right now. You know, why? You know, we've been trying to live these lives. We've adopted a couple of kids, you know, and now I've got this, and how's this going to impact everything? And he told me, he said, look, you trusted your life with Jesus, 1997. Now it's 6 years later. It's 2003. What's that trust look like? Does it look like I'm going to trust God if this next test comes back the way I want it to? I'll trust God when I'm cured. I'll trust God if, you know, or is it trust God, period? And that's exactly where we live. And so that goes with everything. That goes with the, you know, with any kind of health issues. It goes with, you know, when you lose your father. It goes with raising these latest two adopted kids. You know, we know where we're going to put our trust, and we know how limited we are in our abilities. But we also know that, hey, these kids were God's before they were ours too. So we're doing the best we absolutely can.
Well, Ernie, we've all heard wonderful testimonies in our churches and elsewhere of people who turn from a reckless, tragic life of sin to a joyous faith in Jesus. But as you actually alluded to earlier, that's not quite the case for you and your wife, Cheryl. In fact, one thing that was so interesting to me is that you guys had actually adopted Michael several years earlier, before you became returned to faith, as you described there. And I think actually probably most people would have regarded you guys as admirable, good people before you had, you know, returned to faith. So tell us a little bit more about that transformation in 1997 and what Christ has done to bring about that kind of transformation that maybe would not have appeared that you would have needed so much from the outside world's perspective.
Well, I think sometimes that's the problem or the difficulty. And you know, people want to put labels on people. Are you a Christian? Are you a believer? Are you, you know, and that you have to be in a box. I think the thing that it proved to me the most was that even when I wasn't paying God any attention, he was paying attention to us. Yeah. You know, that was, you know, God put Michael, this blonde-haired Romanian kid, in Cheryl's path. You know, we have no doubt about that. We may not have recognized it at the time, but we certainly see it now. And so, you know, I think my awakening to my Christian faith, you know, I grew up a Catholic and was an altar boy and all that stuff. And then I kind of got away from it all when I went to college. And then, you know, things were going so well in my life, career-wise and family-wise, it was like, hey, look, I'm not paying any attention to God, and look where we are. But it was really just after a certain amount of time and seeing where we were in our lives, and I was saying, there's got to be more here than I'm allowing. There's got to be more than my plan. And that's when really just a return to a church was crucial. It was just, you know, here's a place near our house. It's a non-denominational church. It's called Crossroads. There are about 100 people who go to it. Why don't we try it? And we were doing it more for the kids, Colin. It was like, yeah, we'll give the kids a little spiritual grounding since they're not getting any right now. And then in the first 2 weeks that I'm sitting there at Crossroads and I'm listening to Kevin Myers, who's been the pastor since the birth of this church, and now it's this sprawling, you know, central campus with 7 satellites called 12 Stone outside Atlanta. It's a remarkable place. But, you know, in the first 2 weeks I'm hearing him teach, and I'm saying, here's a guy who's about my age, who's got a few kids, and has this wonderful biblical knowledge and this wonderful way of communicating and teaching. And suddenly it was transforming me, and I'm dusting off the Bible that I hadn't cracked for ages, and I had considered this outdated, irrelevant in this time book, and I'm diving in. And so this thing we had done for the kids, suddenly it's like, oh no, this is for more than the kids. This is exactly what I need. This is exactly what I need to see that there's a plan bigger than mine. And then only through that do you kind of backtrack and say, oh, I see. He was looking at me and Cheryl, even back then when we were thinking about going to Romania. And then I can look ahead and say, ah, 1997. That was what was preparing me for 2003 when that doctor said, yeah, it's cancer. And so, yeah, that's the pivotal moment in my life, 1997, December 10th, as a matter of fact.
And Cheryl was not immediately enthusiastic, if I remember correctly, about your faith, right?
Well, we were both seeking, really, at that point, and both exploring. And Cheryl's always been a much deeper thinker than me. And for people who see me on TV and like, well, that's no big surprise, or somebody who's a deeper thinker than you, sure. And so she always needed more proof. She needed more convincing. She wanted less mystery and less doubt and more fact. But it was really one of those things where it was as Kevin kind of poured into us God's word, that we were saying, okay, look, we don't need to have all the answers at this point. God doesn't need us to be finished products to realize we're his kids. And And so while the December 10th was my date in 1997, it was March of 98, a few months later, when Cheryl was like, yeah, I'm ready to take this leap of faith as well. And it's been life-changing for both of us.
Yeah. Well, I have to admit, Ernie, that I don't actually watch nearly as much studio-produced sports shows as I did before. Maybe it's because there's too much of it, or maybe I've gotten sick of some of the politics or the personal drama, a lot of the stuff. But sure. I do make time for shows like ESPN's College Game Day, and I will say, not just flattering, your show, Inside the NBA on TNT.
Oh, you're too kind.
Well, it's insightful. It's entertaining. You guys have a special thing going, and every different person plays his part. And I'm not even the biggest NBA fan. I mean, I watch that stuff, but I'm mostly college football, baseball, things like that. So, but I want to talk about, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion lately, especially related to some of ESPN's layoffs, about politics and stuff like that, and the changing face there. But I want to go back to that post-election commentary, those 2 minutes. We actually had 1.1 million people watch that clip on our site alone when we embedded that video. Yeah. Why do you think that simple two-minute message resonated with so many people?
Well, you know, that was such a strange time, Colin, in those 2 days after the election, because we knew we had a show coming on Thursday, and the thing about having Charles Barkley on our show is he changed the landscape of those studio shows. He honestly did, because his presence on our show and his ability to be the same guy on TV that he was as a player, when he was always the most quotable guy out there. And if any writer who needed a quote on anything, well, go to Charles, he'll say something. And so the way it changed the dynamic of our show to the point where, if something was happening in the world that everybody was talking about, Chuck wanted to talk about it too when we get on the air on Thursday night. And so we've never been afraid to venture out that way. And if the country is fixated on a certain story, you know, we're not afraid to go there in the course of our basketball show. And I think people have come to expect that to a certain extent. And so when the election happened, that was no different. And we all knew, you know, when we talked on, the producer and I talked on Wednesday before that Thursday, and we said, you know, we need to talk about the election. I said, obviously, everybody's talking about it. Why should we be any different? And so when we, that Thursday, I had to think about what direction do I want to go in? Do I want to play this safe? Do I want to say, yeah, what a surprise, I hope it works? Or do I want to be totally honest and transparent on this? And that's what I decided to do. And so I really didn't script anything. I just kind of had three bullet points down on a card that I felt that I didn't really have a choice that I wanted to make in terms of that election. I was not happy with either of the candidates, so I was going to write in. And that I was hopeful still after watching President Obama and the president-elect interact that first day and say, well, maybe there is going to be a difference between the Trump we saw on the campaign trail and the one we see in the White House. And that if I keep saying things have to change and we have to fix divides in this country, I got to be part of that too. You know, that I have to be a fountain and not a drain. And then the third thing I said was, look, if we're talking politics, I've got to tell you, this is the way I process this election is the way I process everything in my life. And that's through the lens of my faith. Now, look, for a guy, I mean, 1996, that wouldn't have been me saying that. But in 2017, 2016, that's where my life was since 1997. That look, this isn't a slice of my life. There's not like the dad slice and the sportscaster slice and the husband slice and the religion slice. My faith is the crust of that whole thing. I can't cut a piece of that pie out without my faith being part of it. And so the only way, as I told people that night, the only way I processed this election was that even though I don't know who's going to be in the Oval Office, I always know who's on the throne. And I told him I'm a Christian. I said, I follow this guy named Jesus. You might have heard of him. I wasn't going to hit anybody over the head and say, look, you better think the way I do, because this is the way, this is how I think. This is how I process it. And so my message was, love others, and I'm going to pray for our leaders. And I'm going to, and that's as simple and as clear cut and as honest as I could possibly make it. And you say you have a million folks on your site. I know 2 days later on a Saturday morning, my wife and I are at the breakfast table. I'm having a cup of coffee. She's got Facebook open and she's looking at the, pictures of the grandkids. And then she says, you know what she said about the election? And I said, yeah. It's got 15 million views on Facebook. And I went, well, dog my cats. How about that? I said, I didn't do this to try to break the internet. I said, I just did this to be honest, and it made me, Colin, what it made me feel, when I walked out of the studio that Thursday night, all I could think of, I said, was for such a time as this, 28 years working at Turner, for such a time as this, where an election would happen like this, where we would have an opportunity to explain how we processed it, and how I would be able to say, look, without Jesus, I can't do this. this is how I look at the election. And then, and look, I realize anytime you're going to mention Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and Jesus Christ in the same 2 minutes, people are going to talk. And they certainly did.
That might be the golden rule of broadcasting right there. If you talk about those three, people will watch. I think that's a great place for us to wrap up there, Ernie. Again, I encourage people to check out the book Unscripted, The Unpredictable Moments That Make Life Extraordinary, published by Baker. Ernie, thank you for your witness through your family, through your show, and now here through the Gospel Coalition podcast.
Colin, thank you so much for having me on. It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.
Support for the Gospel Coalition comes from listeners like you. Learn more and join us at tgc.org/donate.